ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello there, Kirsty Melville here with you. And in today's History Listen, we continue the series, Section 71, High Court Cases That Changed Australia. In this episode, law professor and barrister Patrick Kayser heads back to the early 1990s and the case which came to be known as the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Affair. And just a warning that this story does contain the voices of Aboriginal people who've passed away.
The Hindmarsh Island Bridge is less than a kilometre long. It crosses the Lower Murray River, connecting the sleepy South Australian town of Goolwa to Hindmarsh Island, or Coomerang, as it's known to its traditional owners, the Ngurundjeri people. In 1990, property developers Wendy and Tom Chapman won approval from the South Australian government to build a bridge to their new marina on Hindmarsh Island. The government had recommended they consult with three different local Aboriginal groups in the area, but they only ever spoke with one Aboriginal elder. The South Australian government really wanted to get the Hindmarsh Island Bridge built. It had reached an agreement with a major bank to help finance the development. Under the agreement, if the bridge didn't go ahead, the government could be liable for hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation. And then, an Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Protection claim was made over the site.
I learned about Coomerang and the Coorong and the Lake Alexandrina from my aunt, my mother's sister. They seem to think the only time Aboriginal history is true is a white anthropologist has written it down.
If we got down to secrets, I could see them being never-ending.
This was really, in many ways, the beginning of the cultural wars.
And as you're about to hear, this wasn't just a fight about Indigenous culture or development or power. It was a fight about all of these things. And at its heart, it was a battle over Australia's past. And a warning for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners. This program contains the voices of deceased persons.
After 200 years, white Australian law has finally acknowledged that Aborigines once owned this continent. Today in Canberra, the High Court ruled that residents of the Murray Islands and the Torres Strait owned customary title for their lands.
Only the representatives of the mining industry were left sitting as the Senate erupted.
By doing away with a bizarre concept that this continent had no owners prior to the settlement of Europeans, Mabo establishes a fundamental truth and lays the basis for justice.
The early 1990s saw significant changes for Indigenous self-determination in Australia. When the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Affair began, the High Court had been making headlines for turning the concept of terra nullius on its head. The High Court's 1992 Mabo decision recognised Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as the first owners of Australia.
There was a lot of good spirit around within the whitefella community, a spirit amongst us as a nation that we thought that this is our time that we can get things happening.
Sandra Saunders was the director of the South Australian Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement. She describes herself as a sister to the Ngurundjeri woman who took the fight against the Hindmarsh Island Bridge all the way to the High Court, Doreen Cotinieri.
I'm a Ngurundjeri woman and I was born at Raakan, commonly known as Point Maclay Mission.
Doreen Cotinieri speaking on the Away program in 1995.
I'm the daughter of Thelma and Oscar Cotinieri and I have strong connections with the Coorong and Coomerang.
Doreen Cotinieri, who died in 2007, wanted to stop the Hindmarsh Island Bridge because she believed the site was sacred for Ngurundjeri women. Sandra Saunders.
I remember the day clearly that Dr. Doreen Cotinieri came into Aboriginal Legal Rights. At the time, she was like an acquaintance. She said, I'm here to meet with the lawyer to try and protect what's happening at Hindmarsh Island.
Well, she was an incredibly feisty and strong woman. She had been raised on the mission at Point Maclay, or Raakan, as it was called by the Ngurundjeri people.
Journalist and associate professor at Monash University, Margaret Simons, author of a book about the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Affair called The Meeting of the Waters.
She had acquired an education, really, in the genealogy of the people there, and she had been employed by the South Australian Museum to construct those genealogies, so she had immense respect as an elder within her own community, and she had been awarded an honorary doctorate.
And the missionaries, if they made a decision, it wasn't because they consulted with Aboriginal people, it was to do what they thought was best for the Aboriginal people, which was always wrong.
But she was also feisty, her language could be very blue. She didn't hesitate to excoriate white fellas and some of her own who annoyed her or who she thought was stepping over boundaries. And she's an enormously significant figure, I think, in Australian history. It's a great shame more Australians don't know her name and don't know her history.
Under Australian law, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister can declare that an area under threat must be preserved because it is culturally significant. To get a heritage ban from the minister and stop the bridge, Doreen Cotinieri had to provide evidence that the site was important to Wurundjeri women.
I learned about my kinship from my aunt, my mother's elder sister, Rose, and for 22 years, practically every day I would spend with her, she told me the customs and the tradition that they practiced along the Coorong, the lake, right around the lakes, Lake Alexandrina, and down at Malang, Gawa, and Ironmarsh Island.
Doreen would say that you get told information as you're growing up because someone decides that you're a person that can be entrusted with that information, and therefore you can carry the story on.
I think her core motivation was her relationship with her elders, particularly. I think she had a broad awareness of the position of Ngarrindjeri people, and of course it was the beginning of a revival in respect and understanding of the importance of Aboriginal stories about the land.
Coomerang, to our ancestors, was a place of birth.
So Doreen was told this information, therefore to talk about it across the board was not within the tradition that she was taught.
It's this secret nature of the Wurundjeri women's claim over the site that would later be commonly referred to in the media as secret women's business.
If someone said a place was of great significance to Aboriginal people, of course we have to follow that through and see where it takes us.
My name is Robert Tickner. I had the honour to be Australia's longest serving Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs and held that position during the entire period of the Hindmarsh Island Affair.
In May 1994, then Federal Minister Robert Tickner commissioned eminent law professor Cheryl Saunders to examine Doreen Cotinieri's cultural heritage application. Professor Saunders assessed the evidence. Here's part of her conclusion.
As described to me, Hindmarsh and Mundu Islands and the waters surrounding them have a supreme spiritual and cultural significance for the Wurundjeri people, within the knowledge of the Wurundjeri women, which concerns the life force itself. Dr. Fergie's report describes the area of the Lower Murray, Hindmarsh and Mundu Islands, the waters of Goowa Channel and Lake Alexandrina and the Murray Mouth as crucial for the reproduction of Wurundjeri people and of the cosmos which supports their existence. The adequate functioning of this area is vital to Wurundjeri existence.
Because Cheryl Saunders is female, she was able to read all of the evidence that supported Doreen Cotinieri's application for cultural heritage protection. Out of respect for Indigenous culture, Professor Saunders made sure that some parts of the evidence was marked off-limits to men when she sent her report back to Robert Tickner's office.
This attachment is confidential and should be read by women only. Even without it, however, it is, in my view, open to the minister to conclude that the area has particular significance for Aboriginal people within the meaning of the Act.
In July 1994, Robert Tickner followed Cheryl Saunders' recommendations.
I sought legal advice. I then ultimately made the declaration to protect Aboriginal heritage and spirituality in line with her report.
I think it was a Sunday when Robert Ticknor's decision came through that it would, he put a 25-year ban on it. And we celebrated. It was wonderful. Just happy, happy, having food and dancing and things like that and just gathering.
If it had been a different era, then this story might have ended here. But this was Australia in the mid-90s, post-Mabo. The Keating government had taken steps to recognise Indigenous rights, and this led to a backlash.
This issue of Aboriginal stories about land was absolutely at the centre of Australian politics at the time and Australian self-awareness. And Robert Ticknor made an order prohibiting the building of this bridge on the basis of what Aboriginal people were saying about their connection to the land. Hugely symbolic. On the one hand, a bridge to a little island that nobody outside South Australia has ever heard of might not seem very significant, but the issues surrounding it and the implications were enormous.
In July 1994, the developers, Wendy and Tom Chapman, took Robert Ticknor to the federal court. They wanted to overturn the ban and start building the Hindmarsh Island Bridge. They initially won that case in February 1995. But Robert Ticknor then challenged the federal court's ruling, insisting his declaration should stand. That meant that both Doreen Katinuri's heritage application and construction of the bridge were both in legal limbo, and by the time 1995 rolled around, the Hindmarsh Island Bridge affair had well and truly entered the national consciousness.
Well, my name's Ian McLaughlin. I was the member for Barker commencing in 1990, and the Hindmarsh Bridge and the town opposite Goolwa was in my electorate, so I got interested.
Ian McLaughlin was a member of the Federal Liberal Opposition when the Hindmarsh Island Bridge issue began. He told me that he was sceptical from the outset about Doreen Katinuri's claim that the site was sacred to Ngurundjeri women.
And whether it was objections by the holidaymakers who had houses there or objections by the environmentalists who didn't want to disturb the environment of Hindmarsh Island, there were more and more of these things coming out of the woodwork, and the final one was then one that couldn't be read by any man, and in the end couldn't be read by any legislator who was male. So what built up for me was a series of coincidences that was just got to be a step too far.
As a former president of the National Farmers Federation, Ian McLaughlin was also concerned about what he feared were the consequences, as he saw it, of the High Court's decision in the Mabo case and native title claims affecting landowners in regional Australia.
I thought that the Mabo decision was pretty extraordinary, a decision which seemed to me to be a decision which would lead to innumerable cases and lots of money being made by lawyers and even professors at law.
They arrived in an unsealed envelope at the office of the Shadow Environment Minister, Ian McLaughlin.
How can you say you didn't know what the Aboriginal women's business was in it?
Well, I was in South Africa.
The substance of the secret women's business was written down and sealed in envelopes which were marked confidential to be read by women only, which was the women's understanding of their cultural obligations. Those envelopes went with a whole heap of documents which constituted Cheryl Saunders' report, and they were posted to Sean McLaughlin, who was an advisor in Ticknor's office at the time. But in one of the most extraordinary coincidences of this entire affair, they were misdirected by the Postal Service to Ian McLaughlin.
These documents contained the secret information that Doreen Katinuri believed should only be seen by women who could be trusted. But it seemed that Ian McLaughlin's office could not resist the gold that had fallen into their hands by accident.
And his staff member, Peter Miller, had a research assistant photocopy them, and he admitted to me in the book that he also read The Secret Women's Business, Peter Miller, that is.
You're listening to Section 71, a series on history-making High Court cases in Australia. Today, the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Affair, a legal battle that tore the country apart.
That Robert Ticknor's office, it just banned the building of the bridge for 25 years. They had 30 days ban, then another 30 days ban, and then a 25-year ban. These decisions were being made on the spur of the moment under pressure.
Ian McLaughlin was determined to embarrass Robert Tickner for issuing a 25-year ban on the bridge site based on so-called secret women's business.
That something should be done for, if you like, Narrangeri women in the Hindmarsh Island area. If it were true, then there was a case to run. If it wasn't true, it'd do them much more harm in the long term than good. I said to John Howard, we've got this attachment that looks as though it's secret women's business. And he was very reticent to do anything about it, but I was overfilled with hubris.
So on the 6th of March 1995, a few months after the documents arrived in his office, Ian McLaughlin brought copies of those secrets with him into question time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is again to the Minister of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs. Minister, here is a copy of the secret attachments to the Fergie report, the secret letters. Will you explain why you allowed these photocopies of those secret letters to be sent around Australia like flotsam in a wreck?
The Honourable Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs.
I've absolutely no idea what's in those documents. I don't intend to dignify your grubby behaviour by taking those envelopes. But what I would remind the House about is the record of the member for Barker on this issue of doing everything possibly can to attack the spiritual beliefs of Aboriginal women.
I don't think I've ever been so angry, so utterly disillusioned with behaviour of my fellow human beings as I was that day.
Doreen, she fell on the ground, holding her guts, just in agony, talking to her elders, her spirits, and saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It was absolutely shattering. And she kept saying, I knew I shouldn't have done it, things like that. So it was very devastating for Doreen.
It was probably around about then that I realised that this was not going to be a conventional heritage application, and it was a very political campaign that was being waged.
In March 1995, 4 days after he presented the documents to the Parliament, Ian McLaughlin was forced to admit that his staff had opened envelopes that they knew were confidential, and he resigned from the front bench of the Liberal opposition.
I did something stupid by hand, throwing it over the table to him in a grandiose way.
Do you regret it?
I regret making that mistake.
It was about money, them wanting to build their marinas and all that down at Hindmarsh Island.
I didn't have a view either way about the bridge being good or bad. In fact, as I said before, I'd rather, if the government was going to spend some money, spend it somewhere else.
If you didn't have a strong view about whether the bridge should be built, why did you feel strongly about this?
Because one of the dissident women at the end of all this said words to the effect that reconciliation starts with the truth. That couldn't sum up my attitude better. And I believe it wasn't the truth.
Ian McLaughlin's reference to dissident women brings us to the next twist in the bitter tale of the Hindmarsh Island Bridge affair.
Some other Aboriginal women say the so-called women's business was actually put to them by a man.
They should be tarred and feathered.
The claim has infuriated the women who made the original claim.
If Mr. Tickner is doubting the fact that there are some very genuine and very, I have to say, delightful Aboriginal women who, under great pressure, have revealed that they think that the whole thing is a hoax, then let's have an inquiry.
After he resigned from the opposition front bench in March 1995, McLaughlin met with four Narrangeri women who, like him, were sceptical about the claim of secret women's business. These Narrangeri women came to be known as the dissident women, and it became clear that Ian McLaughlin's office was connecting the dissident women to journalists and commentators in South Australia.
Not all of the so-called dissident women were sceptical of the claims. Some of them were just saying, I didn't know about the secret women's business. But politically, they were different from the proponent women. tended more to see the old stories as part of history, as part of mythology that wasn't necessarily relevant to their present-day lives, whereas the proponent women were more likely to be, I guess, more radical. So there were political differences which really underlay the attitude the women took to secret women's business. There were also personal enmities. Not everybody liked Doreen Continuing.
I was getting threatening letters. I got letters that said, oh, Saunders, you know, you're going to get killed, and threatening letters like that.
But Sandra Saunders also believes that several hundred Ngarrindjeri people in South Australia supported Doreen Continuing's heritage protection claim, as well as Indigenous women from around the country who believed the site was significant to the well-known dreaming story of the Seven Sisters.
There was women from the Pinjarra lands, from up far as Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, that all supported it and they all knew that this was important. So what you take out of it, that's what Aboriginal people were saying. There was a handful of Aboriginal people who didn't know the stories. And in fact, as I remember, didn't actually say, oh, this isn't true, it's all fabricated. They actually say, I don't know, I wasn't told.
Then there was a whole sort of political coalition of interest around putting forward this idea that the claims were in some way bogus or suspect.
How significant was that media coverage of the affair to the bridge ultimately being built?
I think probably the bridge would have been built in any case. There were many different legal claims, but the Royal Commission, I think, would never have been called if it weren't for the journalism, which was in turn informed by this coalition of interest.
By mid-1995, the media line that the secret women's business had been made up put the South Australian government under even greater pressure to get the Hindmarsh Island Bridge built.
After months of claims that the Aboriginal women's business at Hindmarsh Island was fabricated, not one but two government inquiries have today been announced. The South Australian Premier, Dean Brown, says his government will establish an inquiry with Royal Commission powers into whether the women's claims...
Well, I'm saying there's clear evidence that raises very serious doubts now about the whole basis.
And can you guarantee that your inquiry will be an independent one?
Oh, yes, as will be a Royal Commission. And of course it will be independent. And to think otherwise is stupid.
Right from the beginning, they had no evidence. I mean, the South Australian Royal Commission was called on the basis of media reports. Seriously.
On the same day the South Australian State Royal Commission was called, Robert Tickner announced a second inquiry into Doreen Continuing's heritage application. But this time it would be led by a federal court judge. So in the middle of 1995, there was not only a state royal commission underway, but also a federal inquiry. Robert Tickner says that since the Constitution provides that federal law overrides state law, the South Australian Royal Commission could have no real legal impact.
It became a free-for-all to simply mock, ridicule, and attack the spiritual beliefs of the Aboriginal women. There was no proven fabrication. You know, Aboriginal people are entitled to have beliefs which are strongly held by women that may not be shared with men, and that's hardly anything particularly radical in the broad spectrum of the spiritual beliefs we recognise in the Australian community, and these are the beliefs of the first people of the land.
The women got together separately and decided that they would not participate in a royal commission because it was like an inquisition into Aboriginal people's beliefs. Why would we do that? Was basically what they said.
In December 1995, Robert Tickner lost his federal court challenge on natural justice grounds. His declaration banning the bridge from being built was officially overturned.
At all times, I acted in accordance with legal advice, almost on an obsessional basis.
The court said that you relied heavily on evidence of secret women's business, despite the fact that you weren't able to physically view the evidence yourself because you're a man. Was it a mistake to rely so heavily on something that you, as the responsible minister, couldn't test?
Of course it wasn't something that I ultimately could do other than deal with when the report was presented to me.
Yesterday, the Bridge Royal Commission in South Australia found secret women's business halting the development was fabricated.
Commissioner Iris Stevens was forceful in her report, labelling the women's business a complete fabrication to prevent the construction of the bridge. Ian McLaughlin, who resigned from the shadow ministry over the Hindmarsh Island affair, claimed some reporters had become lost down the path of political correctness.
And you can finish up with things like secret evidence and get the wrong result.
The Royal Commission found that they had lied. And that was on the front page of the Adelaide Advertiser. It was read by white and black South Australians and, of course, had by that stage become a very potent national political issue. And the women who were being accused of lying were the elders of the community. It robbed them of that respect. Of course, some of the dissident women were also elders in the community. There was a real split in the community. And it was scarring. It intersected with both white fella and black fella politics and was incredibly destructive and damaging.
I always believe that truth prevails, and like that's why I work at Aboriginal Legal Rights, you know. So I had this belief that at the end of the day it would be all right. So the day the decision came down, all the staff, lawyers, everyone was there, I just broke down and cried and cried. It was just shattering. And I felt as though something had been taken from me. And I felt as though I had no emotions left, had nothing left. It was very, very shattering. And it's still painful to think about it. Takes me back to that feeling.
I think now we'd perhaps be a little bit more aware and critical of that notion that white fellas can be experts on Indigenous people, not the people themselves. I mean, it would be nice to say that this wouldn't happen in the same way again, but at the same time, there was a very, very powerful coalition of interests. This was really, in many ways, the beginning of the Cultural Wars.
And that was journalist Margaret Simons. Next time, in part two of the Hindmarsh Island Bridge Affair, it's 1996. A federal election has just been called.
Our aim is to get our possessions back, our development back, our compensation, the bridge built, and get on with our lives.
Narrangeri elder Doreen Cartanieri decides to take her fight over country and culture to the highest court in the land.
I'm afraid I'm not going to give in. I went into this honestly, truthfully. I will go out the same way, honestly and with truth.
You've been listening to Section 71, hosted by Patrick Kayser. The producer was Jane Lee, the supervising producer Michelle Rayner, and sound design and engineering by Melissa May. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you next time for another deep dive into our past on the History Listen. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.